Welcome everybody to this session, which is called Live Hacking Smart Contracts. We're not actually going to do like DEF CON style hacking into live systems. What we hope to do is to have a kind of interactive session with the audience where we discuss security. That's one thing, discuss it from like a high level perspective. And meanwhile, also trying to actually find bugs in the nitty-gritty details of the contract. There will be technical glitches. We will have to switch over the viewports from different laptops and stuff. I hope you'll have some patience with that. First of all, I'm Martin Holsvende. I work for the Ethereum Foundation with security, Ethereum security, and also Geth development. With me, we've got Matthew DiFerrante here, founder of CK Labs, smart contract auditing and...
Yeah, crypto research and stuff.
And we got Richard Moore.
Hello.
Author of Ethers.js, and also, I know, does...
Random stuff.
Random stuff. And we were just joined by the awesome Nick Johnson,
woo,
who came right from a ENS AMA. So the idea is that we take a piece of code, which someone here submits, and we discuss it. And if possible, we would be very grateful if that someone is willing to come up on stage and chat with us for a bit and talk about the contract. And as far as I know, we've received one submission so far over Twitter. So is Mr. Appleton present and would he like to join us? In the room?
I guess they're not here.
Because they're not here. That's a bit unfortunate because one of the things, like from a security perspective, that it's good to do is get a general high-level understanding what does this contract do and what are the assets. So we kind of have a bounce on what can be lost and what would be like the worst case to happen and get an idea of what to look out for. Since this particular contract was submitted yesterday, I think all four of us have probably taken at least a peek on it. Does anyone of you guys want to have seen something interesting? Should we go from top to bottom, or say what we think about this? So it's a token contract, which, to most appearances, is quite normal. It has an owner. There's a transfer. And this is actually a pattern here which I'd like to raise as a good example, which I call the double dispatch ownership. No, sorry, it doesn't have that. It has a single dispatch. So when you transfer ownership of this thing to someone else, it has a check to see that you don't actually transfer it to no owner. And then it just sets the owner to the new owner. There's another way to do this. The double dispatch is that you set, you don't set the owner to new owner, you set the potential new owner to the new owner. And then the actual new owner needs to make a call to accept the ownership. That means that you know for a fact that the owner of the contract is capable of making Ethereum messages and interacting with contracts. Then we have the ERC-20 implementation. And we have SafeMath. So, nothing really to mention about the SafeMath. That's kind of standard.
Although it might be worth noting, when you're looking at somebody else's contract, you might want to check to make sure the safe Mac was copied over and they aren't hiding bugs in that. Because you might just gloss over it and be like, oh, I trust it. And then,
Yeah, I think I feel like that's one thing that is like would be really helpful to have like compiler level support for like import the code that has this hash.
Right.
Because oftentimes, like, yeah, it's very easy to just assume this is fine. It looks like it's from Zeppelin
or ENS name maybe, so that you can import safemath.eth as opposed to, because then you can just as easily lie about the hash. It's
bunch of random. I mean, if the tool grabs like something based on the hash, like
if I'm looking at Etherscan, I see like import some crazy hash. I'm going to trust that this is safemath and not some sort of.
Oh yeah.
Okay. But if it says safemath.eth, I have more faith that it's like.
So I think ETHPM is trying to accomplish this sort of thing. Okay. And with some compiler integration, that would be a good starting point.
Right.
So here's the ERC20 implementation of the specification. And so I'd like to ask you guys, and to give some context, the ERC20 specification states that the transfer method should return a Boolean whether the transfer was successful or not. And as you can see, and this is quite common to see, that it actually never returns false. It either returns true or it throws. So what was your guys' opinion? Would you make a note of this in the audit? Do you recommend against it or for it?
I would definitely make note. Like, the problem is something, another contract might be calling us to do something, and now you've caused that contract to fail as a result of, you know, it's supposed to return false if it didn't work, as opposed to bail out of the universe.
I'm of the opposite opinion. ERC20 was broken when it said that you should return false and not revert state changes if you try and do something illegal. And tried to fight to get people to actually revert when, you know, illegal changes are made, because it's far too error prone to try and handle things with an undo mechanism yourself rather than relying on the VM's mechanism. And if it's hard to handle a revert in Solidity, then that's a problem with Solidity that we should fix.
Well, I think it's also just, it's probably better for at least the next year or two to just use the throw pattern, just because I don't think you literally wouldn't have enough gas for non-trivial contracts to do try accept locks, right? Like the amount of checking, I mean, like it's already a nightmare to do try accept locks in normal software. If you're trying to do with all the constraints of the blockchain and of the EVM and the amount of stuff Solidity doesn't support out of the box is I think the amount of errors will go up a lot. And I think the ERC20 standard was a bit messy because I mean, like, this can only ever return true, right? I mean, this is never going to return false. Most contracts do that. So why even have a Boolean at all?
Well, the original idea was that it shouldn't ever throw. It should return false if you tried to transfer more tokens than you had, for instance. Mm-hmm. And I think that's broken.
Yeah, I feel like I've been overthrown, but I mean, that's my argument is, even if the specification kind of sucks, we should still follow the specification and make an ERC 20 plus something that says don't do dumb things.
So to be fair, I don't think this is non-compliant, because the ERC 20 doesn't say anything about whether you can throw or not. Right. If you return successfully, you have to return true, but throwing in a case of a failure isn't prohibited.
That's fair.
And then, like this is like a real, or has been a real bad problem in the compiler, where it's not strict enough. Like, you could, for example, write at least up until very recently, you could write this function without ever returning true, right? So, like, take away that return true, and it would still. Like, it would just put a zero on the stack, basically, right?
Silently return false.
And return false.
And then between compiler version 4.22 and 4.23, like, a bug was fixed with the call data return, where I guess, like, it was made more strict. So now those contracts actually return zero on the require.
Yeah, so the output area is cleared before the call is made.
Right.
Earlier, the output area was the input already resided there.
Yeah. And because the compiler was too lenient, now, like, if you compile a checking contract that wraps a require around the token transfer, and the transfer goes through okay, but it returns zero now, like it properly allocates that zero, then the contract will throw even though it's actually gone through correctly.
I don't quite get that, but I'll bug you afterwards to get those details.
Another thing worth mentioning here is the lines 123 and 124, I think. I can't quite make out the alignment. 124 and 125 are redundant. If 124 isn't. The check that the value is less than the balances is also enforced by safe math.
Yeah, but safe math has two assert.
It depends on the version of safe math you're using.
Mm.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah. For the room to hear, so the comment was that the safe math fails on revert.
Assert.
Assert, right.
And
yeah. In this version.
And it's a good question, like it's kind of a philosophy question. Are you using safe math because you believe it should like throw in the case of an honest mistake, like the idea that if a safe math method ever fails, it represents an error in the contract? Or are you doing it because you want it to automatically catch overflows for you? And one philosophy leads to revert and the other to assert.
So the comment from the audience is they remove the safe math check on line 128 and instead do a regular minus. Yeah, so these are basically the same check. And
well, the one on 129 checks against overflow, so 128 could succeed, and yeah.
So, and one important stuff to see that they got right here in this section is that you do the subtraction and addition in the right order, so that you don't, like, I want to transfer 10 tokens from myself to myself, and then you add it to yourself, and then you can do it kind of wrong, so you get the double amount.
If you do it the other way around and you have zero tokens, you can still transfer a million tokens to yourself.
Mm. All right, let's move on. If there's any submissions coming in while we're talking, keep them coming. Keep them coming.
So it's not a necessarily a security issue, but it is a events issue. If you add to the balance before you subtract and you start off with a zero balance and you're transferring to yourself, then you add a million tokens to your balance and then you subtract a million tokens from your balance and that succeeds. And it emits an event saying you sent yourself a million tokens, which shouldn't be possible.
But wasn't there also a case of one of these tokens where you could increase your own balance?
Yes. So the bad consequence would be that it could be a little fake overflow if you first increase the balance, and if you're transferring from to yourself, then you effectively will double your balance, and this can overflow, even though that this is impossible because the total number of tokens is less than maximal out value. But I wanted to comment about the safe math implementation. Actually, it has some bad style there, I mean this one implementation on the top, because it allows overflow actually to happen and then try to detect it afterwards. No, not this, but the implementation of safe math, right? Because it's heavily relies on the particular behavior of overflow.
Which particular one are you talking about?
For example, this one, multiplication, right? So it first allows overflow to happen at line 58, right? And then tries to detect it afterwards, heavily relying on what exact result. So it's obvious that if overflow didn't happen, that at line 59, everything will be fine. But the opposite is not obvious. I mean, it's hard to prove that if overflow actually happened, then condition at 59 will be violated. It's not that easy to understand. And you need to know the particular behavior of how overflow works. I mean, what exact result will overflow return? Right? So it's better to check before doing actual multiplication, to check that it's easy check. You need to define max allowed value by one argument and compare to another.
Yeah.
And the same problem, I think, with addition. But not with subtraction. Subtraction is okay, but addition.
Is this from a practical point of view?
No, actually, the overflow behavior is predictable, at least in EVM. But it's not that predictable in Solidity. right? Because, for example, the division by zero behavior already changed in Solidity while it didn't change in EVM, right? And so we can't guarantee that overflow behavior will not change in Solidity in the future, despite right. that in EVM it will stay the same. But here we rely on the particular overflow behavior instead of preventing overflow at all. And so in terms of gas cost, it will be the same. I mean, preventing overflow or detecting it afterwards. Okay.
So I wanted to point out something that transfer from isn't doing, which is the what I consider at least the anti-pattern of requiring, sorry, not transfer from, approve, of requiring someone to set their approvals to zero before they can set them to another value. That was mooted in result of the issue with sort of front running with transaction approvals. And in my opinion, the correct way to handle that is for end user clients to send an approval to set it to zero first and then just to reset it, not for contracts to enforce it. Because
could I just give some context on that? So it's basically if Nick approves that I can use 10 of his tokens, and then at some later point he says, no, Martin, he should only be able to spend 5 of them. And I see his approval is on the network for 5 tokens. So then I quickly grab the 10 tokens and his approval comes in and I can grab another 5 tokens. Then I got 15. So that's
And the correct way to handle that is either with first setting the app, either first setting the approval to zero and then back, but not for the token contract to enforce that, because there are, for instance, smart contracts that use the approvals mechanism. They're doing that atomically in a single transaction, so they're not vulnerable to this race condition, but they will nevertheless be broken by a token that does this and possibly irrevocably broken.
Yeah, I mean, the contract has increase approval and decrease approval, but then it also has approve. I mean. Yep. So it would have been great to just null out approve.
Then it wouldn't be C20, of course.
Yeah, whatever.
Yeah, so this increased approval, is that standardized in any way?
Not really. It's a de facto standard. I think there's an audience question too.
Oh.
For example, if I'm a malicious user and I see a transaction that reduces my approval to zero, so wouldn't I just transfer those 10 tokens anyway?
Yes, and nothing can stop you from doing that. It prevents, if it was 10 and I'm setting it to 5, then without this mitigation, you could spend a total of 15, because you could spend the 10, and then I reapprove you for 5, and then you spend the 5.
It also prevents you from the other direction. Even if you were approved for 10, I changed it to approve you for 20. In this scheme, you could take 30, right? Because you take that initial 10, and then when I bump it up to 20, you're actually able to take it. So it works in both directions.
But this, like, setting it to 0, and then this has to happen.
Yes.
Right, so setting it to 0 and raising it again to 5 has to be 2 separate transactions.
What the submission website
on me? I think in response to the tweet was the official submission venue.
Yeah,
we can probably post it somewhere afterwards as well.
But I think he wants to know how he can get it, draw a submission to our attention now.
Oh, I see.
Is there a submission somewhere in some queue?
Yeah.
Cool.
It's a camp for the ERC20 QR thing that I posted, but I posted it wrong. I just tagged you guys. I didn't reply to the tweet.
Right. We'll go through this a bit more until, because I think there were some, and then we'll jump to the next one. This is the actual contract implementation and not just boilerplate. Well, there is actually mostly boilerplate. In the constructor, it says issue cards for, what is that, from line 255.
But there's 100 of them. I counted.
There's 100 of them. And every call to issue card here in this constructor will increase the total supply to 100 and set the balances of these hard-coded addresses. And then there's this, and that's an internal thing, so no one can call that externally. And then we have the buy card.
There was actually one quick thing I want to point out with the issue card. On this part, they actually did right. Oftentimes, in the constructor, people allocate tokens and don't call transfer, which means that there's no transfer events. So if you are writing a tool that works against like status or one of those other apps that looks at the history to figure out how many tokens you have, if you were allocated 5 tokens, for example, in the constructor, and a transfer never happened, and you're just looking for those events, you don't actually know that you had 5 tokens. So that I thought was.
So that means in minting function, you should also transfer.
Right, from zero to whoever.
Yeah, so. And it's also good. It's also good, like a reminder that the transfer event is like merely a helper, right? So a lot of apps, like just kind of assume the transfer event as the absolute truth, but it's good to always at least check on chain whether that transfer event represents reality.
Right. And one other quick comment I might make as a shameless plug is there's a system called Merkle Airdrops that might have worked better here. For 100, maybe not so bad, but you can imagine you don't want to, if you're putting this out into 1,000 people's hands, not everyone maybe use their card. It makes more sense to Merkleize it and just submit the Merkle hash and then force people to claim it. If that works in your case, it might not work in all cases. But I could imagine situations where deploying this, especially if you want to issue 10 million cards, would be infeasible.
There are a couple more audience questions.
Sorry, I just use the microphone because I still have it. I think that issue card has a bug here because it can lead to inconsistent total supply. Because if you issue card to the same address twice, then the balance will be still one, but total supply will be increased twice.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay.
Right. Since addresses are hard coded, this can be discovered at the at the code at the this stage where we're at. But you're totally right that in itself, yes, that is flawed.
You also bring up another good point. If I was doing this, I would probably sort the cards. So by inspection, you could tell easier if there was a duplicate one.
Yeah, I think this is a good. I think regardless, I would change this because this is an example of like very fragile code. If the guy decides, I don't have. Hard-coded list. I want it to be dynamic, and then he changes this, and then he forgets to say, issue card wasn't made for that, and he'll deploy that, and then somebody buys something once, and then he'll lose one of them, right? It's like always, it doesn't really cost. Would probably end up being like 5 more opcodes, but it's good.
Yeah, it would only be like a balance 2 dot and then plus.
Yeah. Oh no. Okay. Yeah.
Like
so always
200
to try to make your code as anti-fragile as possible, just because it works. If it's wonky, but it works in this specific situation, just change it so that it works in the general case, because you'll forget to change it later on.
Having been a security auditor in general IT security, one thing that I've learned is that ask a lot of stupid questions and don't be afraid to look stupid, because it makes things go faster if you just spit out things you don't understand. And I actually don't understand really how bicard works, because here money comes in, it checks some stuff, and it emits an event, someone bought a card, and then sends the money out to somewhere else, doesn't actually make any storage changes about who owns the cards. So there's no like...
I have a little external context on this.
Yes.
The author of this contract is present at DevCon and is selling physical cards. If you transfer one ether using the bicard function with a hash, and then you provide him in person with the pre-image, he will give you the physical card.
Right. So it's a one-off purchase physically that you get the card in. Right. So that's where there's no actual state change, meaningful state change in the bicard function. Sorry.
So along the question of asking questions that may be, silly, but use of a pre-image for securing an asset means that you may be front-run because it's a symmetric secret, meaning that if you observe someone attempting to claim this and you're not modifying the state of the actual contract, someone else can observe the fact that you've omitted that transaction and attempt to perform the same action to claim the card.
Yep.
So that would be a concern.
In this specific case, all you would be doing is just like paying for someone else's card, right? Because I think like the data isn't exactly a secret. Like it's not meant to be a secret, right?
Well, it's a hash of a secret.
Right. If you submit somebody else's hash of a secret, then you just wouldn't be able to reveal it in person.
Yes. And if you're talking about front-running the reveal, then in this case, this is an in-person reveal, so you would have to literally jump in front of them and shout the secret.
I misunderstood the intent then, but yes.
It's a good point about commit and reveal schemes in general. You need either the commit needs to contain some data that makes it impossible for someone else to front-run it, such as the target address, or you need to use something other than just a simple hash reveal, like using a key pair.
So quick question. I didn't realize the context of this contract, but you just mentioned that. How does the owner actually issue the card to the person?
He hands it to them in person.
I mean, but in the contract, or they don't?
They're buying a physical object. Each of these cards he's handing out has a key pair on it, and each of those cards is listed in the contract here and owns one token. And then he will physically give you the physical card, and you will now own the key pair that owns the token.
What is the token actually used for?
Okay. So, representing that you have a card.
Yeah, so it does seem misused to me.
That means all cards are fungible?
They should probably be NFTs. Instead.
Yeah, that's a weird, like, card collecting system. Yeah. All cards are the same, basically.
I'd just like to mention one more thing on this contract before we can move on to the next. And if one of you guys can start bringing up the next contract, so we can switch over to that. This, I think, is very good to have an emergency drain on a contract because you never know what people are going to send to it. So even if you don't expect, I mean, you can prevent getting ether, but you can't prevent getting tokens. So if the tokens wind up there, it's nice if the owner can ship them off somewhere else. And I think this kind of also nicely demonstrates a minor pet peeve that I have with Solidity. And it is that owner, in this case, is an address. And doing the owner.transfer actually means doing a call with next to no gas, which is not vulnerable to reentrancy. And the transfer also protects it. If it fails, it will throw. Whereas in this style, mm-hmm. where it's an ERC20 interface, and it looks oddly similar. I mean, it's a something.transfer, but actually this is a full-blown call with all available gas and totally different semantics. It also has a return value, which you might or might not read out. And as an auditor, it's when you're doing a manual audit, you have to be really careful about all these things. Is this an address, or is this an address in the geese of an interface and actually a full-blown call? That's kind of a thing that you can trip on.
Wasn't there a talk of deprecating that or no? Are we?
I'm not familiar with that.
Basically,
what?
0.5 the bits address table for transfer as the normal address with transfer on the send table anymore.
Okay.
So
transfer was a recent introduction to the address object. Is there?
Yes.
How will you transfer to an address in future?
Oh,
I see. Okay, so for anyone that didn't hear, there will be a new data type payable address, which you can cast an address to, and it only has that method if it's a payable type. Sorry?
So the comment is that you have to make it explicit in the constructor for that to happen. But what do you mean in the constructor of what? If you have an address as an object,
if you call the method within like a function and the function itself does not have payable, it won't be registered. Like it won't allow that to actually happen.
No, you can always send funds out from a non-payable function. We're talking here about whether you can calling the transfer method on an address, and apparently in future there will be an address subtype, and only that will have the transfer function to. Right.
Right, so this is, I don't know the right terminology, maybe it's a keyword, but it's like oddly, so in this case, it's a synthetic thing which has been added, syntactic sugar on the address type, and this type is a method with an actual concrete method called transfer on an external account. And for security, there are very different semantics and they matter a lot.
Yeah. So I've had a couple of people send me things in tweet DMs. I only have my phone here, so please send them to other people as well.
Yeah, while I set this up, just describe what the contract does, if you could.
Yeah, so hi, everybody. My name is Brennan. We've created a work contract. we've created a work contract so that you can deposit tokens in it and then be eligible to be selected to complete work. So you say deposit 1,000 tokens, and then now you can start working in some capacity. So it's still a work in progress, so I think it's going to get shredded. But the idea is that you deposit a certain amount of tokens, and then the work manager is able to withdraw from that deposit for jobs. And as soon as that deposit drops below the size of the job's requirement, like the stake, then you'll become suspended. And so that forces you to deposit back into the contract to refill your work tokens. So if you can imagine, it's like the work deposit is sort of, that is the number of jobs you can have on the fly, if you will. So there's a few things that we haven't implemented, like being able to withdraw, but having a restriction on the timer, but I'm not sure if it's absolutely necessary, so I guess I'll hand it off to you guys to have a look.
So is there a new token, or are there like...
I've actually left that out. It's just ERC-20, so you can just, you know, instantiate it.
So will this thing be dealing with assets of value such as Ether or whatever valuable token?
Just a custom work token.
Just a custom work token.
Yeah.
So at this point, is there anything, you know, what are the assets? Are there any assets that have a value?
No, just the inherent value of being part of the work contract so you can participate in the jobs. Mm-hmm. So that the value exchange is outside of that. You become eligible to take part in that value network by staking tokens in the work contract. So,
all right.
Yeah.
And who are the different actors in this model? So you have someone who does work.
Yes. So you've got the worker who stakes the initial deposit. You have the job manager who's responsible for pulling out the job deposit, if you will, which is going to be smaller than the initial deposit. And then, of course, you have the owner of the contract who can deploy.
And the owner of the contract, is this, can he do administrative stuff on the contract?
Mm-hmm.
Like what?
If I recall, it was a couple of weeks ago, I believe it's just instantiating it, and then there might be...
They can set the stake limit, for example.
Right, yeah. There's a few public variables that you can adjust. So hopefully it's small enough for you guys to grok.
Okay. So let's see. Where would a user? What would be the first action a user does?
Let's start. So you deposit stake.
Okay, so let's go. It's quite hard for a lot. I have to look at two different things.
So the owner is just like an admin that manages this. Okay.
Okay. So. Oh, fuck. Okay, so the owner deposits their stake. And it seems like they get tokens deposited, sent back to them, right?
Yeah, and just to add to this, the worker has to approve the transfer before this deposit stake is called.
So one thing I noticed in the deposit stake is it doesn't seem to care whether it actually succeeds, like token.transfer from, you might have the allowance, but you can imagine there could be other restrictions like can't send to a contract address or something weird, like it's
or you might just not have enough tokens.
Right, absolutely.
So
yes,
here,
you're right.
Here's one of these cases where we have this ambiguity, right? Where if this token is actually an implementation of the ERC-20 specification, which conforms exactly to the letter of the specification, and this transfer from fails and returns a false, we just don't care about that.
Yeah. So it's a case of being liberal with what you accept and careful with what you omit. If you call transfer, you should always wrap that in a require.
Right.
Yep. Yeah, the check for the allowance isn't necessary because the transfer call will fail if you don't have an allowance. Okay. And in this case, the check for the allowance is actually a call out to another contract, so there's a minimum of 700 gas plus state reading fees.
Right. Yep. So, yeah, always wrap your important stuff in requires.
Which, again, is the sort of thing you're talking about, because transfer and solidity is explicitly doesn't require you wrap it in require.
But then, yeah, so it's quite confusing. Yeah. Also, one thing here, so going through since that deposit stake calls the deposit function, if you're gonna import SafeMath and use it in some places, best to use it everywhere consistently, at least in my opinion, because otherwise it's, if you get used to seeing mixed code, some SafeMath sometimes otherwise not, it's also gonna become too easy for you to look at a line that needs SafeMath and then just ignore it because you're just used to, you know, like the cognitive overload of like keeping track of which threshold am I using SafeMath on, it can easily get mixed up.
As a more generic thing, I want to point out as well, like a lot of auditing is just kind of getting your head wrapped around what the contract's trying to do in the first place. Going back to the description, like it's...
That's kind of why being an effective auditor ties well together with not being afraid to ask stupid questions.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. Oftentimes, like the biggest vulnerabilities are the ones that are most obvious or the ones where, like, you're reading the code and it kind of... It's structured in a way to make you believe something that isn't actually true. When you get that inclination to be like, oh, should this really be this way, it's important to voice those concerns and actually act on them, as opposed to being, oh, I'm sure that's fine, nobody would get that wrong. We've seen some pretty drastic outcomes based on, that kind of...
Right.
Mindset. The
two lines being flipped.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So the error messages are like the other way around. So it should say stake is over the limit, not stake is below the limit, because that's what it throws when it fails.
So my partner agrees with you. I like to express what the Boolean is.
So
but that's, I feel like, a philosophy.
No. This is an error message that will be thrown, right? It should tell what went wrong.
But he's stating what condition was violated.
Right. Yeah.
I agree with you, but I can see the other side, at least. Okay.
Because you can imagine the output would say fail and then explain what was supposed to happen.
This is a question going back maybe like one or two steps when we were talking about wrapping the transfer function in a require. Is that like a general good practice for when you're making a call out to another contract function that you should wrap it in a require if you don't have some other mechanism to check to be sure that it succeeded?
Yeah, so like, that's a good question. So like, definitely don't take from this that you should, anytime you're always calling out, you should always wrap it in a require, because that in itself can create vulnerabilities, right? Like if there's a contract, for example, that iterates over a bunch of addresses and it wants to give a payout to each of those addresses, right? If one of those addresses is a smart contract that's malicious, it can just throw the moment you give something it, and then you send something to it, and then all the other payouts are stuck because of my malicious contract. Mm-hmm. And I could blackmail you with that, saying, now you're all going to send me one Ether, otherwise I'm going to block your two Ether payout forever, right? So you should first of all, try not to do that loop construct, which is bad, but besides that, you should wrap things around requires if and only if that line failing is just critical damage to your contract, right? If this line fails, then nothing should happen, right? Otherwise, try to catch the return, right? If there is a return.
You need to be very context aware. It looks like Martin has something to say.
So I think, isn't there an overflow here in deposit?
Say
which
again?
Is an internal function, but an overflow, because the balance, the amount is U256, which arrives from a couple of lines above, mm-hmm. and it is addition there without overflow checking. It will overflow. The new balance will be below the stake limit, or not necessarily.
So,
or maybe necessarily.
From a quick look through, I think all the places deposit are called the amount is set by the smart contract, so it can ensure that plus total supply is not an overflow, but it speaks to talking about making anti-fragile code where you should add these checks even if you don't think they can happen.
It also just makes the code more readable. Even if it's going to be guaranteed, it's nice from a readability point of view.
Could you scroll up a bit so we see where it's called, the deposit?
So there's one at deposit job stake as well.
Yeah.
It's called a few times.
So that calls deposit, but required stake there comes from a public state variable of the contract.
And I guess that's the only one.
There as well.
It was required.
Yeah, it's also called from here.
Several calls to it, but in each case, I think it comes from a state variable.
I think
given the context, it's fine, but it's not robust.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think that's also, this is also another good point. I always sort of suggest that if you have multiple functions, right, calling a lower level function or like an internal function, and there's some a security issue that could arise if those wrapping functions do not perform a certain action, in this case, making sure that the allowance is within a certain value, then you should absolutely move the check or the constraint to the shared function, right? So in here, for example, like, you know, by putting safe math here, take away an overflow vulnerability from any function that uses this function. And so the people, you know, when you're extending in the future, when people are building against your API, they don't have to have the cognitive overhead of, this function is vulnerable to overflows, right? So if there's a mitigation that you can build in, that's, you know, where there's an issue that's that multiple functions may suffer, always put that mitigation in the most deep function call.
Another question, there's a function there, select worker. I assume the goal is that gets called off-chain. The select worker function, does that get called off-chain?
No, it does get called on-chain by something else that supplies the entropy.
Okay, by another smart contract then?
Essentially the job manager.
Right. One thing to bear in mind there is you may not be selecting uniformly at random, because if your range of your random values isn't a modulo of the size. So probably a better approach would be to expose the number of stakers and expose a way to index the stakers and then let the caller figure out how to select uniformly at random, because this hides the fact that it's doing modulo and you think it's just, you know, magically gets an even distribution.
If you Google modulo bias, you'll find a nice, concise way to take the max minus the modulo minus the size. It's like a little bit more complicated, but you defeat modulo bias.
And of course, if you're doing the checks on chain, doing the pseudo-random generation on chain, then all the usual caveats about random numbers on chain apply.
And this is also vulnerable to front running if you can increase the length of the stakers before that select worker gets it called.
Yeah, so if you're off by one from being chosen, you could.
So I have a question. Will you be using some KYC system for the workers?
Well, I think that's kind of outside the scope of this, right? I mean,
it depends, because if you won't, the stake limit does nothing. It's not... like the stake limit, to limit the maximum stake, so maximum chance of each worker can be bypassed by just registering with multiple addresses inside the stake limit. So it's not Sybil resistant without a KYC system, right?
It's funny, we actually explored that because we were considering letting people have a lot of stake and then weight the workers proportionally according to how much stake they have. But computationally, that's very challenging, because basically this is O1 for all the operations, and at best it'd be ON, depending on how you want to balance read optimization versus write optimization. So we decided that KYC be damned, I guess. We just let them, if they have a million, they can stake that many addresses. So, but again, I think it's kind of outside the scope of this. It depends on how you want to use it. But you bring up an excellent point, I think. I mean, the stake limit, so the question was, wouldn't it be better to get rid of the stake limit then so you can stake as much as you want? And that's still an unopen question that we've been talking about, because really, if you can just only do one job at a time, then really you only need like the job stake amount minimum.
Yeah, and I think it's something to keep in mind in general when you're doing these sorts of things, is to keep in mind, because that's definitely an issue, like when people can be, when many people could actually be one actor. And this is a pattern we do see a lot, is people just trusting, no, one address means one person. But like you said, if you have a million addresses and there's only two other workers, you have a 1 million out of a million and two chance of being picked for this thing. So,
All right. Should we? So we got one tiny submission that we could take a look at that. We have like 10 minutes left. Alternatively, we could just talk about our favorite pet peeves or whatever.
Thanks, guys. By the way, thanks, guys.
Yeah, no worries. Thank you for coming on stage.
Yeah.
Here you go.
Yeah, so this is pretty small, pretty straightforward, and I wanted to kind of kick off the discussion. I mean, I think all of you will immediately see what I'm getting at. Line 21. So, given that there was some changes in the new Open Zeppelin version 2 and so on in this direction, I wanted to kind of kick off the discussion towards reentrancy protections and so on, and what all you guys think about that, given that you were also partially involved with that and so on.
Yeah, so I think the first thing is that is contract is, you know, like, just generally, stop doing this. You know, don't check if things are contracts. There's no way to do this on Ethereum that's foolproof.
There is.
No.
Well, you can prove that it's not a contract by checking that the message of sender equals origin.
Sure.
But you cannot prove that it is a contract.
Like, one of the big issues is counterfactual. I can compute the address a contract will live at, and now I can use that, but in the future it becomes a contract. So, right, if the TX origin's equal, yes.
But I think in general it's an anti-pattern, because we want to build a system that is interoperable, and if you can't build a secure contract unless it's being called by an externally owned account, then you need to rework your contract so it is.
This
one's
broken
anyway.
As for the mechanics of this, Nick, you want to...
Yeah, so if you call self-destruct, the contract's code size will be zero, even though the contract is still callable for the rest of the transaction. So you could exploit this by having your contract self-destruct itself and then call this and then do reentrancy and then die afterwards.
No, hold on. No. No, the Xcode size will not be zero.
Am I getting it back?
Until the end of the...
Yeah. The Xcode size will still be the actual code size until after the... But the constructor, that's it.
Yeah.
Because the construct during the constructor in
yes,
the code,
you're right,
then
sorry,
the Xcode yes. size of that address will be zero.
And yeah. I would still not. I don't know. The TX origin thing doesn't make. It's not a comfortable assumption for me long term. Because, like, for example, what if we have TX abstraction in the future, right? Like the things coming from the on-site address, that there may be actually be code there, because it may count the depending on how it's implemented in the future, it may count the stub as code. There is actually, I think, maybe only one foolproof, future-proof way to do this, which is check the hash of message sender against a signature of message from that address, right? Because smart contracts, obviously anything that is a public contract can't have a private key. So if you make sure that you get a signature from whoever is calling, then that's like I would assume a foolproof way.
Probably.
Yeah.
Who knows what crazy moon math we'll have in the future.
We'll see,
like,
yeah.
It's
really important. You can also just check the external code size on
I mean, I think in this particular case, it might not actually be exploitable, because it then relies on calling the thing it asserted wasn't a contract. So if it's still in the constructor, it has no code and you can't call it back yet. But again,
Nick,
I'd still say
could you explain? I didn't catch that. So what was the idea?
No, but
anyway, the idea is that you have a two-step KYC process for contracts, where the first the first transaction they call in a set of Boolean or something like that, and then in a separate block they call again. If you check external put size on the second block, second transaction, and it's not zero.
Yeah, in this case, if message sender has no code, it still works because it's just a value transfer.
Yes, but it can't be exploited for re-entrancy, which I assume is what the author was worried about.
I do have one quick question, actually. Can you set the init code to be empty so you can actually have a contract with no code?
Yes, you can. Okay. You can just literally return 0 bytes.
Yeah. Great. So that idea, by the way, with that depends on that the idea that for a transaction, a later transaction, the cannot have a zero code size again because the constructor will not be run again. And if it's in a different block. And that is true for about another month. But then we have create two coming,
ooh,
which kind of changes the semantics and the pattern of contract creation a bit. So that, and it will have quite an impact on security, on the security aspects of how you deal with external contracts and assumptions that you can make, because it will be possible to take down a contract and replace it with something completely different on the same address through the use of loading the actual body code from an oracle on chain in the constructor, because the address is determined from the init code and not from the actual runtime bytecode.
And actually, I take back what I said before. A smart contract, there is technically an extremely statistically unlikely possibility that you can create a smart contract address that you have a private key to. There's collisions in the namespace.
But it's Meteors simultaneously hit every Ethereum practitioner in the world, unlikely.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, possible.
Yes.
Can I just follow up on that? Could you explain a little bit better? Is that within the realm of reason, a reasonable way to check if you have a smart contract calling you by requiring also a signature being given?
Yeah, I mean, it's like getting that collision is like, you know, one in 10 billion universes.
But please don't do it.
Right.
Yeah, but please don't do it, though, because it's... Systems are much more useful if they can be interacted with by other systems than if you try and enforce that they can only be interacted with by users.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, that's what a bit what I meant. Like, for example, OpenZeppelin now has the re-entrancy guard, right? Mm-hmm. Like, should it be used, or are we kind of giving up on security because we are using the re-entrancy guard and admitting that we are incapable of rewriting like re-entrancy safe code?
Well, I think
the re-entrancy guard structured like this, where it can only be called by external code?
No, it's with a counter. So.
Yep. So I would call like a mutex, like a last resort. It's better than this, but it's still like you should be able to write your code without mutexes. Yep. If you really can't, then actually mutexes will get more efficient in the next hard fork because of net gas metering.
Oh yeah. Yeah, but be careful. Everyone read up on Create 2 because that's going to break a lot of assumptions, you guys.
it's also open up a lot of opportunities as well.
Yeah. Yeah.
So there are like only a couple of minutes, and the next team are back to back.
Yep.
So we can have like one more question or so.
Why wouldn't this contract be vulnerable to re-entry? Couldn't I just call deposit and send in the constructor of a contract?
Yes, but if you call send, then it will try and call you back. And because it's in the constructor, you don't yet have any code at that address, so it won't be able to be re-entrant.
Yeah, the code, the way that Ethereum works is that the constructor returns a string of EVM bytes, and only at the end of the transaction are those connected to the contract.
Thanks.
Do we have time for one more?
What's the best way to, with transferring some value, to set the gas limit?
The easiest way is to use dot transfer, which sets it to the minimum, which is 2100 or 2300.
If we want a dynamic, if we want to choose the limit and not have the 21,000.
In Solidity, you can do function name dot gas in brackets and then second set of parentheses for the function arguments.
But the thing is, even if you provide zero, there is always the 2300 gas
Right, only for value sending transactions.
If you have a value.
Yeah.
You have to send at least one way.
Yeah. But generally it's friendly to send at least 2300 gas, even if you don't have to, because that way they can log events, which means, you know, otherwise it can have no effect whatsoever. Mm-hmm. Cool. I think that's all we have time for.
Yes.
Awesome.
Yeah. Thank you, guys. Thanks. Thank you, audience.